welcome all of you today to our AGMD Chronic Intestinal Tube Obstruction Telephone Internet Community Support Group. I'm so glad that you're able to come to this meeting, especially where this is Rare Disease Day. This is a special day because the National Organization for Rare Disorders, which we are members of, as well as the Rare Disorders Organization, has come together every year to produce these rare disease events. And there are things going on in each state or government where they're lining up at their state house or they're doing some things within their own organization. And I thought, well, when I scheduled these, knowing that this was Rare Disease Day, that having one with pseudoobstruction, which is definitely rare, although I'm questioning whether it's rare, it's just underdiagnosed, would be a great day to have this particular program. For those who don't know me, my name is Mary Angela DeGrazia Zatucci. I'll tell you a little bit about my background. I'm a longtime patient with chronic idiopathic intestinal pseudoobstruction. At the age of 26, I began to have severe problems and with GI problems, and I was misdiagnosed as irritable bowel, it's stress, gastric colon, it's all in your head. But I continued to lose weight, and so I was then given the diagnosis of having anorexia nervosa and an eating disorder. And when I was in the hospital during this time, and it was in this month that it all began and it all started to unravel, that they used to come in and every morning they would bring the scale in and the nurse would say, all right, step on the scale. And if I gained a pound, she would clap. If I lost a pound, she would reprimand me like a child. Then when it came time for meals, they would give me a glass filled with water and Metamucil and then food. And it wasn't like I didn't want to eat. As all of you know with food obstruction, it becomes very challenging to eat. My belly was always distended. The pain was excruciating. I was nauseous. I was vomiting. And they were monitoring how much I was eating and reprimand me, too, if I didn't take the Metamucil, which, if you've never had that before, this came in a powder form. You put it into the glass, and if you don't drink it right away, it solidifies like almost like a Vaseline type of a consistency. Not the right thing for somebody who has pseudoobstruction. Finally, fast forward 5 years later, a doctor said, I think you may have what's called a motility disorder, and I'm going to take you for a test to see if you have pseudoobstruction. And after all of that time, I took all the tests. My wonderful husband was right by my side with every test because it was during the time when a lot of these manometry tests, well, they weren't covered by insurance at all, so we had to pay out of pocket. But also, they were in primitive states. So my husband was very involved with some of the tests where he had to monitor something, and if something came off the graph or the lead, then he'd have to go and put it back on to make sure. At any rate, diagnosed with pseudoobstruction, and I was 1 in 5 in this part of the United States, supposedly diagnosed with it, and I'm in Massachusetts. The doctor then wanted to remove part of my intestinal tract, and I was down to 69 pounds. I didn't feel, I mean, I had so many questions, and I would pose them to him. Would, if this intestinal tract was removed, would it guarantee that I'd be better? And he said, well, you may get better, but we doubt if you'd get worse. Then I'd say, well, will this go into other parts of my body? He didn't have an answer. Is this genetic? He didn't have an answer. Every question, the answers were vague or there was no answer. And I was getting pressured in many directions for the surgery because everybody was desperate to have me get better. Ultimately, I decided not to have surgery. And in my particular case, it was the best decision for me because many people who have pseudo-obstruction and have surgery, I mean, it can be very beneficial, but then you run into the problem of potential adhesions, and which can add to the potential blockages. With that, when I decided that I did not want to have the surgery, the doctor refused to treat me. My husband was by my side. I was on the table with my Johnny, and he said, "I think that you have something to gain by being sick. I think you are being a martyr, and I think that, you know, your husband really needs help because he is not speaking up and allowing you to make this decision. And I really think you need psychiatric care, and unless you get that, I can no longer be a doctor." And with that, he slammed the door behind him and left, and I never saw him again. So I was without a doctor for many years, trying to figure out, now, well, what do I do? Finally, it had a name, and that was a good thing, because I went all of those years without it having a name that was accurate. But now I knew it's pseudo-obstruction. But now what do you do with it? So with that, now fast-forwarding, the years went by, and it progressed to include my entire digestive tract and my bladder. In fact, every system in my entire body has been affected, and there is that a clear opinion of many doctors that this may be related to mitochondrial disease. With that, in 1991, because I had experienced so many bad things, and I really did not think that I was going to be able to live, because I was told not to do anything at 69 pounds, I was going to die. And as I was a pianist, you know, you can't play the piano anymore, you can't exert a lot of calories because you'll die. And eventually you're just going to die very early and within a matter of months, year. And like so many of us, we defy science, and perhaps there's no explanation. In my case, my explanation, I feel, is it's got to be my father, my God above, who has kept me alive for this, for so many reasons that I appreciate. And giving up a career, giving up all of those things was so challenging. In 1991, I decided that I wanted to start a nonprofit organization to help people so that they wouldn't have to go through what I was going through. Originally, it was named the American Society of Adults with Pseudo-Obstruction. Later, it was changed in 2000 to the Association of Gastrointestinal Motility Disorders. And I often joke and say, well, I think God gave me a little bit of everything. I have a gastroparesis, I have achalasia, diffuse esophageal spasm, malabsorption, so that it will help me to really understand even better what patients are going through. Because I wasn't the first one to raise my hand and say, give all of these things to me. I really want them. But seeing though this is what God has given me, I have to also add that it's such a privilege and honor to be able to help and serve so many people. But with rare disease, with this rare digestive disease, let me just roll out a couple of little rules here, guidelines, that if you would like to speak, please say your first name every time you speak so we can match the voice with the person who's speaking. Do not share any of your personal contact information with anybody on this call. If you'd like to reach out to somebody, you can reach out to AGMD via email or telephone call, and then we can get in touch with that person to see if they would like to respond and communicate. And it goes vice versa, too. Don't ask for anybody's contact information. So I wanted to just say that with this, with chronic illness, such as pseudo-obstruction, there are many different challenges that we face, not only on a daily basis, but through the course of our journey, and one is trying to get the correct diagnosis. I don't know if any of you were diagnosed right away, but you perhaps may want to share that with us today. And then, of course, it's you know, doctors are trained in school that if you, the saying is that if you hear hoof beats, it's most likely a horse and not a zebra. We don't follow textbook with our symptoms. And it's so hard sometimes to have doctors treat, let alone diagnose us. And many of us with pseudo-obstructions can have individual symptoms. So I may have pseudo-obstruction, have this symptom, but somebody else may not be able to. Some patients can exercise, and I admire them. My exercise is just getting out of bed. That's a huge thing for me, or walking down the hallway. So I wondered if you wanted to talk a little bit about your journey and how you obtained your diagnosis, if it was right away or if it took a while, the course of treatment, and what available resources that you may have found that are helpful. Anybody want to jump in? Oh, we have another quiet group.
I'll jump in. This is Brittany.
Oh, I recognize that voice.
I have pseudo-obstruction also. I presented with symptoms from birth, basically. My mom had normal pregnancy. I was a full-term baby, healthy weight, no complications at all. But after being born, I did not pass any meconium stools. But for some reason, the doctors 30 years ago decided it would be a smart idea to still send me home. And within the first 24 hours of being home, I was projectile vomiting, which scared the living daylights out of both of my parents, I'm sure. They took me into the emergency room right away at the local hospital, and that hospital transferred me to one of the bigger hospitals in the area, and at 3 days old, I went under for my first surgery. At that point, they thought I had an obstruction, obviously. Like I said, this was almost 32 years ago. So they didn't have, I guess they didn't know to, or they didn't have access to, or they didn't have the technology to do like testing before they just went in for surgery. Or maybe it was because my symptoms were so severe that they just figured surgery was the best option for me. So, like I said, they went in for surgery. They could not find an obstruction, but when they went in, they, and my mom likes to tell the story, my intestines looked like wet noodles, which is exactly how the doctor put it, meaning they were completely atrophied. So the surgeon ended up resecting part of my colon. When they examined the colon, they couldn't find any ganglion cells, which are important in the intestines to have. So they resected until they found the ganglion cells, closed me back up with a temporary ostomy, which meant that they just, at the point where they resected to, they pulled that part of the intestine up to the abdominal wall, stitched it in place, and placed an ostomy bag over that to catch the stool. And they thought, you know, within time, I would be able to be reconnected, quote unquote, normally. And I did okay, but once they started introducing food again, all my symptoms came right back. So I went back in for surgery, and where they had found those ganglion cells, they weren't there anymore. Where they went to, that's a good question. They just disappeared. So they resected more intestine, again, closed me up. And at that point, they also put me on total parenteral nutrition. So they inserted a IV line into one of the major veins in my chest that goes straight to the heart to give me all of my nutrients, because I obviously could not eat. At that point, they thought I had Hirschsprung's disease, which I, from the information I've been given, it kind of presents similarly to food obstruction. So that's what I was diagnosed with. And I ended up having several more surgeries within the first 4 years of my life. Obviously, I do not remember those, and I feel like I am one of the lucky ones that doesn't have to remember any of those surgeries. And by the time I was around 5 years old, they found that I wasn't responding like a typical patient of Hirschsprung's disease would. And my surgeon found a study that was being done at UCLA. So they got me into that study and sent me to UCLA, where I was then put under the lovely experience of having the antroduodenal manometry study done. Unfortunately, that is one of my very first memories, and a very unpleasant one at that. All I remember is being separated from my mom during a horrible procedure of shoving a huge tube down a tiny nose, because I was really tiny, and not having my mom anywhere near me. And I, up to that point, always had my mom near me when I was having procedures done, and unless I was obviously in the operating room. But otherwise, any other procedures done that I was even semi-awake for, my mom was with me, and they had separated me from my mom. Come to find out many, many, many years later, this study that was being done on me to find out if I had food obstruction was also looking at the parents for Munchausen, which is when a parent or caregiver intentionally harms someone under their care, or harms themselves and intentionally makes them sick. So they were actually thinking that it was very possible that my parents were doing this to me. After the studies were done, they found that, no, my parents were not doing this to me. I, in fact, had food obstruction. And my case does involve most of my GI tract. I think it's starting to progress into esophagus involvement and possibly bladder involvement, but it's not affecting quality of life at this point in those two cases. So right now it just affects my stomach and small intestine, because I no longer have a colon. They also removed 17% of my small intestine, and now I have a permanent ostomy. And I am also on still on IV nutrition. I can eat and drink. I just I have severe malabsorption, so I don't absorb what I consume. The other odd, I guess, issue with me is that my stomach and my duodenum are actually the same size, and they're not supposed to be. The stomach's supposed to be larger, the duodenum's supposed to be smaller. So for me, when I do eat and drink, or even if I don't eat and drink, everything just pools in there, and I have to deal with bacterial overgrowth a lot. I did not know of another person with pseudo obstruction until I was, oh geez, I think I was 19. And I talked to a parent whose child had pseudo obstruction, and I found them on the internet. I always thought I was alone in this fight. I remember when, you know, the internet was, you know, becoming this huge thing, and people, you know, always would say, oh, you should Google it. And I would always Google my disease, and nothing would come up. And I actually remember the first time I Googled my disease, and something came up on, I don't remember now if it was WebMD or Wikipedia, but it was one of the main kind of websites, and I was so excited that they actually had something. And then within this last year, I found AGMD and talked to Mary Angela, and she was the first adult that I talked to with pseudo obstruction. So I thought I was alone for many years. But I too have found that there has to be some reason for me to have this disease. And I think I have found my purpose now, and that is volunteering and trying to help others with this disease and understand it and deal with it and cope with it and accept it. And I feel like my real strength is helping parents whose children have this disease and giving them hope that their kid can live, you know, into adulthood and live a happy and fulfilling life. Because I know my parents, they didn't have any support when I was a child. And they were told, well, first they were told that I wouldn't live past 6. Then they were told I wouldn't live past 8. And then they tried to give my parents another time, and my mom just looked at them and said, you're not God. You don't know how long my child has. So you can stop guessing now. And they stopped. So, but yeah, that's my story.
So, does anybody else want to share their experiences? All right, well, that's okay. As long as you, you know, if you're here and you're listening, I'm sure that you're going to at least come away from this program knowing that you're not alone. I think, too, the emotional toll that it takes, and I know over the course of my illness, when this first began, I was, every minute of the day was accounted for. I was embracing life. I was everything. I was involved with everything. And then it all came to a halt. And you feel like you're in a world all by yourself with your family. And the rest of the world is going on normally. And now you kind of don't fit in anymore. And that, when I look over at my journal from the beginning of when this happened, and then the lowest point when I was trying to get diagnosed, then I was diagnosed and then abandoned, and then it was progressing to finally coming to terms with this is what I have, and it doesn't mean that we're still not getting emotionally involved with everything that happened, you know, the emotional roller coaster, because with pseudo obstruction, as with many of these other motility disorders or even rare diseases, but even with gastroparesis, it's unpredictable. So you can be stable one moment and then the next minute, boom, it's a very bad day for you. And it can happen in a blink of an eye, which is why on our website, and it's been the theme of our organization for years, not only as a beacon of hope, but in one moment, your life can change. All because, in our case, of a motility disorder. And with that comes a new life, and it's up to us, with the help of others, to create that new life so that we now do not have this disease dictate everything, but instead we're working to integrate it into our life, and we compromise on the days that it's not so good. Well, then I guess the disease has won that day, but that doesn't mean the next day I'm not going to try something different. And I've said this many times before that along with keeping a journal, what I do is at my desk, I keep a pad of paper and I put the date on it and then I number it. And with everything that I get done, I don't care if it's just a little thing, I write it down. So if I texted someone, I write that down. If I was on the computer or I talked to somebody, I write that down. Now, some days the list is very, very short, but other days it goes on to pages, and those are the real victorious pages. And it makes you feel a little bit more comforted when you have those off days and you feel, oh, I've wasted the whole day, but you haven't. Because you only have so much energy, too. I don't know if you, Brittany, have found this, or even you, Laura, but even though you don't have suit obstruction. Laura, say hi so people will know your voice.
Hi, everybody.
Okay. She's probably sitting on her new plush rug.
Mm.
See?
I am.
And the energy level can be so debilitating in many instances. So I know, Brittany, you have a lot of problems with energy, correct?
Yes. And I guess it's a blessing and a curse, but naturally my voice is kind of always peppy. And especially depending on my I try to only surround myself with people that are good for me and I'm happy to be around. So when I am around people that I'm happy and you know, that, you know, I care about a lot, my voice always sounds really up and sounds like I have a ton of energy. But what's funny about that is, and I love the fact that these are all just conference calls, because I wouldn't want anybody to see what I look like right now, because I'm literally sitting in my bed in my pajamas, hooked up to my IV, and leaning back on a pile of pillows. So, you know, I have enough energy to be on this call, but if this was a meeting or I felt like people were going to be able to see me, I don't know if I would be able to attend anywhere near the amount of things that I can doing it on calls. My energy, I get about one day a week where I feel like I can actually do things, accomplish things. And I honestly, my other half has 2 days off back to back, luckily. But I try to rest as much as I can leading up to those 2 days that he has off, and then try my best to do as much as I can, and, you know, take a short nap those days, but only, you know, kind of try to limit it just to a nap and not staying in bed all day. Otherwise, that's what I'm more or less doing the rest of the week.
Yeah, it's budgeting. It's budgeting energy. How about you, Laura? Because you have that gastroparesis, but you also have diabetes and neuropathy and Barrett's esophagus. So how is your energy level?
Some days it can be gone. I usually, if I... through all kinds of tricks with gastroparesis, I get up in the morning and I'm not always feeling sick. If that's the case, I get up very early. I have most of my energy in the morning. These calls usually are the end of my day. I will do everything I can before, like, noontime. Mm-hmm. And then my body just says, forget it. You're basically done. And I either go to bed or, you know, on the couch, something, but I can't keep going. Even just, like, talking becomes mm-hmm. really, like, you know, you really feel expended. You kind of like, wow, what happened? You know, falls in that spoon theory. You know, there's days we don't have that many spoons. And I just, I think it is with all motility disorders. I know, just on a side note, my husband had a major diverticulitis surgery a month ago, and they told him that one of the biggest problems he will have from healing going forward, and he is having it, is exhaustion.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he is, you know, he has a sit-down job, but he gets out of there, and he's like, I feel like I ran all day. You know, like I've been running. And it's, I think, all motility disorders somehow, you know, anything to do with our digestive system tends to steal energy from people. Maybe in different ways, but it does take your energy. Pseudo-obstruction's got to be, you know, that's so much, not, I don't say it's a bigger, but it's a bigger area. You know, it's not just the stomach. It can be down here in the intestine. It can be moved over there. And, you know, that's got to be, the more that's affected by it, by your issue, I think the more exhaustion you feel or, you know, that it creates. So I, you know, I feel for everybody with that because I know, just like you guys, you know, you go, go, go if you can. And I do the same thing as you, Brittany. My husband has the weekends off. I will, you know, Friday is like rest day completely.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't make big plans or do anything big, but I just try to be able to be there all day for the most part, you know, and then I'll go to bed early or something. But, you know, my husband's like your husband, you know, very good. He knows me. He can tell, you know, if I'm about to crash, he'd be like, all right, we're done. Let's go watch a movie or something because he knows I'm pretty much done doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's just one more symptom that we all have. Keeps us in common, I guess, all the motility people.
If you figure that the gut is governed by so many systems within the body, then that gut is in control of a lot too.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not getting good oxygen and brain to your brain, that's going to start failing. You know, there are times when there's confusion. There's times when you just kind of, they call it brain fog. You'll probably hear me do that on this call. Like last call, yesterday I renamed Brittany another name.
Yeah.
It just happens. And it's really difficult to, I know the three of us who have spoken, have people in our lives who are very supportive and helpful. But when you're living alone and you have a chronic illness, it's even worse. Mm-hmm. And I know that fear is really sown into the lives of many of us because I always look at fear in the face. I don't want fear controlling me. But I'll tell you, when this is in full-blown attack and I'm all of a sudden thinking I have to go to the hospital, that fear starts coming in because I'm concerned about what's going to happen to me, but I'm also concerned about what's going to happen when I go to the hospital. And I've explained this to before, that the last time I had to go rush to the hospital because of pseudo-obstruction, the doctor came into the emergency and he said, so what is your name again? And it's right on there. And I said, Mary Angela DeGrazia DeTucci, and I'm throwing up. And then he says, I said, chronic intestinal pseudo-obstruction, and you know, my belly is out like I'm ready to deliver twins, and I'm in so much pain. And he says, okay then, wow. So you tell me what I'm supposed to do for you. And I did. I said, good. But as funny as that was, and it was a good thing in one way because he was allowing me to kind of control the situation because I've been there so many times before. Had I had an obstruction, now that would have been a totally different scene. But I always like to try what has worked for me in the past. And then one nurse came in after that, and she said, what do you have again? And I said, well, I have pseudo-obstruction, I have gastroparesis. I went through the whole list. And she says, will you tell me about it? Because I've never heard of these before, and I want to learn. And that was, like, huge for somebody in the medical profession to admit that they didn't know and to want to learn. And so that ended up being an okay experience, but I do something that you probably shouldn't do, which is when it's in that really bad state, I try by willpower alone and by an act of faith not to go to the hospital as long as I can. And then like, the body tells me, no, you better go. And then I have to go. But that's a little stubbornness. No, 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 this is going to go away. It's going to go away. And then I go away to the hospital. That's the result. So I don't know if it's the same thing with hesitating to go.
Yeah, this is Brittany. Yes. I have, I guess, another issue on top of pseudo obstruction, and I truly believe that it is very much linked with pseudo obstruction. I get gastrointestinal bleeds, and I used to get them when I was a child. I would get them randomly for a while. It seemed like every month I would get them, and they would vary in severity. You know, sometimes it would just last a couple hours. Other times they would last a long time and I would have to go to the hospital. And I'm able to know that I have a GI bleed pretty easily because of having an ostomy. So I'm able to see, obviously, what's coming out of me through the bag. And having an ileostomy, my output is quite a lot. I don't have thick stool at all. It's pretty much watery all the time. At the most, the consistency might be like yogurt, but I don't form actual stools. So I'll see that blood right away, and I can tell if it's active or not by the degree of redness, I guess. So if it's bright red, I know that that's an active bleed because it's fresh blood. It's, you know, coming out right now. If it's black, it means it's older. The bleeding probably has stopped or is about to stop. So I used to have them when I was little, and then for some reason they disappeared. Again, we don't know. There's so much of this stuff that we just don't know, that's all a mystery. And we had tried to figure out why I was having these bleeds. I mean, we would track everything. Every drop that went into my mouth, we would write down. Everything that I did, I mean, we just could not find a cause for it. I had so many different tests and procedures done that we actually got to the point where, like, where we told the doctors, no more. We're not going to have I had so many endoscopies done, which is where they put the tube down your esophagus with the camera at the end to see what's going on in your stomach and the beginning part of your intestine, kind of like the opposite of a colonoscopy. But anyways, I had so many of those, and they were all so inconclusive that we eventually got to the point where we said, no more, because all you're doing is putting me under anesthesia every couple of months to find nothing. So those disappeared for so many years, and then I would get them like maybe once a year here and there, but they weren't severe. They would go away real quickly. And then in the last 2.5 years, I started getting them again, and they started coming again every few months. And I am just like Mary Angela. I don't go to the hospital unless I have to. And I will fully admit that I waited too long to go to the hospital many times. And especially with these bleeds, I would hope that they would go away. So I would wait, and by the time I got to the ER, I was dizzy, my heart was racing, I would get horrible headaches, and as soon as they drew my blood, you know, they would do the blood count, and your hemoglobin, which is the count of your blood, should be between, I think the level is like 11 and 14 or something like that, and I'd be at a 4. So they'd send me straight up to the ICU, and, you know, I'd be hooked up to 47 different monitors, and they'd be looking at me like I'm going to die any second on them, and I'd have to get multiple units of blood and all of that fun stuff. So, yeah, I definitely have waited, and, you know, possibly too almost too long to go to the hospital, but then I have times where I've had these bleeds and they do go away in an hour or two and I don't get any symptoms and I don't need to go to the hospital. So it's a very tricky thing to decide. And, you know, and like Mary Angela said, you know, you have to deal with doctors who've never heard of these diseases or these conditions. And I think there's a big fear on doctors' parts too, that if they can't fix you, they don't want to do anything with you. And these diseases can't be, quote unquote, fixed. There is no quick fix. There is no pill. It's managing symptoms. It's managing the disease. And unfortunately, we live in a society where lawsuits happen all the time, and doctors are now afraid to treat because they can't cure, and they're afraid that you're going to then turn around and sue. And I've had doctors come out and say that to me. And I've gotten to the point where I'm like, I wish you guys had forms for me to fill out that say, I will not sue you for treating me. Because that's all I want you to do is just treat my symptoms so I can go home and go back to my life. But that hasn't come out yet.
Wow. Well, it's... Anybody else want to jump in?
Yeah.
Oh, sure. This is Laura.
Oh, hi, Laura. Okay.
Hello. As far as the hospital goes, my beginning journey with my gastroparesis many years back, they didn't really know what it was, but I was in the hospital. We racked up 32 admissions in 2 years. And, excuse me, every time, my problem was at the beginning, I was nauseous and vomited constantly, nauseous 24/7. But I would stay home and, you know, and unfortunately, when I get vomiting, it turns cyclical for me. It's not the syndrome, but it repeats constantly, and it will keep going. And I'd vomit for a week straight. If I was awake, I vomited every 15 minutes before I went to the hospital. So when I got there, I was a wreck because I'm also a type 1 diabetic. So it really was bad. I finally learned, you know what, forget that. If I have medicine and stuff that I usually can stop the vomiting with at home, but if I can't, it happens occasionally, if I can't, I don't care if it's only been 2 hours, I'll go to the ER. I'm like, you know what, guys? And I was very lucky where I live. I've lived in this town for 9 years, and it has a hospital. So the first time I went in with this a few years ago, and I was in the hospital probably 7 times a year then, we explained it to the ER doc very carefully, my husband and I, what she needed to treat me with, because she didn't know, you know, for sure what I get treated with. And it turned out to be the best thing I ever did because there's a huge problem out there now with anybody going to the ER looking for pain relief. Big issue in this country now. Pain meds, you know, if you go in asking for pain meds, they're going to label you a drug seeker. But when I go in, instead of asking for that, I tell them to please look at the record, look in the computer. It tells you last time I was here exactly what to do. And I've also been able to go to other hospitals in the area and tell them to call them. And that way I don't have to ask for pain meds. And I will get some in there, but it's more for the actual first dose of it is more to knock me out than it is for pain. It's to stop the vomiting. But I used to wait so long. And even the hospital yelled at me because they're like, you know, by the time you get in here, you're so dehydrated that you're, you know, almost without fluid of any kind. And screws up all the blood counts, you know, and it's just a nightmare. So now if I have to go, which is not often anymore, because I can control a lot of it at home, but if I do, I go right away now. I don't wait. It's not worth, you know, feeling that bad. Have them fix it quick.
That's great, having some sort of a protocol.
Yeah, it's tough, but they really did go with it. You know, they went with it for me, and they do have a record that says this is the protocol when she comes in for this disease, you know, and it's great. You know, if I can just get them to put type 1 diabetes on their intake forms, I'd be good, because now it's all type 2.
But, so we only have, thank you, Laura, we only have 4 minutes. So I'm going to just ask anybody, what is the greatest lesson that you learned from having your illness? That's part A. And part B, what advice would you tell other patients or parents of patients? Anybody want to jump in with that?
I can. The greatest lesson that I learned is I think the acceptance, not just acceptance of the disease, and acceptance is definitely different than getting into the disease, but I also have learned acceptance of people and of all people, of no matter what your situation is. And I think I've developed a sense of, I guess empathy of people never knowing what they're dealing with behind closed doors, because I know for myself I deal with a lot behind closed doors that nobody would know about, and I wouldn't want to be judged for things that people can't see. And I think for advice for anybody with this disease is not to give up. And that's hard to do. I've almost given up several times, but looking back on those times, I'm glad I didn't give up. I'm glad that I'm still here. I'm glad that I didn't give in. And, you know, you never know, like Marianne just said, you never know what's coming around the corner. And it could be something as simple as, you know, attending one of these calls and meeting somebody that becomes a lifelong friend, or finding advice that, you know, could really help you in your life. You never know what is around that bend, and just to keep going.
Beautifully said. Laura, do you want to jump in on that?
Actually,
no.
Thank you, Brittany. You can hear me, right?
Yeah.
Thank you, Brittany. You said exactly what I was about to say, pretty much. The learning the acceptance of just everything in life. You know, before I was sick, I was, you know, I lived my life. I was, you know, like all of us, we're selfish. We deal with our own stuff. We don't really even acknowledge other people unless we know them. And after being sick now, like Brittany says, I can accept people, whoever. You know, and I don't judge them ahead of time because, again, closed doors, you know, it could be anything. And it also is, you know, there's another human factor that, you know, a lot of people deal differently. You know, what a pain level 3 for me might be a 9 for somebody, and that's just throwing it out there. You know, things are different. So we all have our issues. And I always kind of go with, well, you know what, we were all born the same way, so I guess nobody's better than anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I've learned. Nobody is better than anyone else for any reason. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, and we're...
So much wisdom here. The thing that I would like to add is something that I've learned is about perspective of people and judging or being judged. So when I see a person, I will never, ever, ever judge them upon their appearance, because I know people will hide how they're feeling. Some people may be in a bad mood, but you don't know what's going on in their lives. Some people may have a scar on their face, and yet, you know, they're very self-conscious. Other people may not. So when I see somebody, I'll just compliment them on something they are wearing or the way they have their hair. But I will never, ever say anything, wow, you look good today, because I know how that feels. The second thing that I would say to share with everybody as a lesson learned is never doubt yourself. Believe in yourself, even if others doubt you, that what you are experiencing is very real. And I know it can be very easy when people do judge or they just don't believe you, whether it's in the medical field, family members, friends, coworkers, wherever. But pseudo-obstruction is very rare. It is rare, and it is very real. Unfortunately, the name pseudo-obstruction can be very misleading, because pseudo meaning fake, or it mimics something, but it's very real. So don't give up on yourself, and communicate as much as you can with others who truly do understand. We're all here together in this. We're all here to draw awareness, help each other, and support each other. It is certainly an environment of people who understand, because we've been there, done that, and we're still traveling that journey. Some may be veterans having been in it for a long time, and others may be new to it, and some may be middle of the road. Wherever you are, when somebody says, oh, you have pseudo-obstruction, or I have a motility problem, you know, there's an instant bond that takes place, because it's unique to the world of our chronic illness that we are living in. On that note, I want to thank Brittany for sharing her experiences and wisdom, and Laura for sharing your experiences and wisdom. For those who are on this program who just listened, I want to thank you all. You are really such an inspiration for this organization, whether you spoke or not. When this organization does any activity, know that you are all behind this, and it is not an organization of one person or one person that's dictating everything. It's an organization of all your voices collectively. And on that note, may God bless you all. Please feel free to contact AGMD for any reason. And don't be strangers. Our next one we haven't scheduled yet, but we are having right after this a gastroparesis group, which is going to be co-facilitated by Laura, and that's at 12:30. So God bless you all. Take care. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, everyone.